This is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, meet Biyet Rickner. The pediatrician went to Cambodia to help the country rebuild, but he took more than his medical skills.
I was known in Switzerland as entertainer, as Beato Cello. My name is Beat. My instrument is cello, and together our name is Beato Cello.
Plus, in Ethiopia, if a man kidnaps a young girl instead of courting her, he avoids paying a dowry for his bride. And herbal medicine. For rural Americans, it's not a fancy new trend, but an age-old practice.
In the spring of the year, we were given sassafras tea, and there was a bitterweed tea to clean our bodies. In the fall of the year, we were given teas again to prepare us for the winter.
That and more ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Biyet Rickner vividly remembers when chaos took over in Cambodia. It was 1975. He was a young pediatrician working with the Red Cross at a hospital in Phnom Penh. Rockets began striking the capital. The Khmer Rouge took over power, and Rickner was forced to return home to Switzerland. In 1991, when the civil war finally came to an end, Cambodia's king personally invited Rickner to help rebuild the nation's devastated hospitals. Rickner returned with more than expert medical knowledge. He also brought his cello. Reporter Jason Struther brings us this story from Siem Reap.
All beds in the intensive care unit of Jayavarman 7 Children's Hospital are full. IV drips are attached to screaming infants. Other young children lie unconscious, their mothers attentively waiting over them by their bedside. Each morning, Dr. Biyet Rickner and his Cambodian staff examine the newly admitted patients.
We have today 32 meningitis and 27 encephalitis. So it's a catastrophe.
When Rickner returned to Cambodia in 1991, he witnessed firsthand the havoc caused by 15 years of war. When he saw the ruins of his old hospital, he almost lost hope.
And the other facilities were empty. And you cannot know exactly how is the situation for children at this time, because they stay at home and die at home.
Rickner says he thought he'd stay in Cambodia for only 2 years. 17 years later, he's opened 5 new hospitals where 8.5 million children have been treated over the years, free of charge. The hospitals receive just a small amount of funding from the Cambodian and Swiss governments. The rest, about $25 million a year, comes from private donations. And to help raise money, Rickner turns to a skill he learned when he was a child. Every weekend, in an auditorium attached to the hospital, Dr. Rickner plays his cello for tourists visiting Siem Reap.
I was known in Switzerland as entertainer, as Beato Cello. My name is Beat. My instrument is cello, and together our name is Beato Cello. And I played as a clown in theaters, in concert halls. I played for children too in hospitals.
Most of the audience comes to this town to tour the ancient Angkor Wat temple. They learn about the concerts from travel books or brochures passed out at hotels or by rickshaw drivers. Rickner serenades them with Bach and talks about the health crisis that afflicts Cambodia's children. He asks for donations, but if they can't give money, he asks that they roll up their sleeves and donate blood.
And this concert gives us a chance. It's like a window to talk about these problems.
After the show, the audience of about 200 people gather in the lobby. Most place cash in donation jars. Others buy videos or CDs of Rickner's performances.
Heard about the concerts, was given a flyer earlier on today, so we said we'd check it out, but when we arrived we weren't really expecting what was told to us, I suppose. 4 of us here bought something and donations.
What impressed me most about him was the fact that he you know, despite all the problems that he's faced, he's obviously succeeded extremely well.
So it's just a good way to, you know, hear some music and just to see the other sides, you know, besides the Angkor Wat and all these temples and all these great things, to actually see, you know, what are the lives of ordinary, you know, typical Cambodian people.
Rickner says the money he receives on the spot is quite minimal, but after the tourists return home, many send checks to his foundation. In 2007, his concerts raised nearly $8 million for the 5 hospitals he oversees. The morning after the concert, Rickner takes me on a tour of Jayavarman 7 Hospital. Mothers cradling sick children sit on blankets spread out across the red tile floor of the hospital's outpatient center. A young woman rushes by with a seemingly lifeless young boy in her arms.
This is surely a dengue case, a child in shock.
Dengue fever, a disease that causes high fever and severe abdominal pain, can be fatal if left untreated. The boy is handed over to a doctor and is admitted into the ICU. Rickner bids me farewell and heads back to work. The chaos here in the hospital stands in stark contrast to the serenity that Rickner creates during his cello recitals. Rickner believes music gives him the balance and comfort he needs to cope with the dire poverty and death he sees on a daily basis. He says it's also helped him overcome the guilt he still feels for leaving Cambodia 30 years ago. Rickner pledges that he won't leave behind Cambodia's children again. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Siem Reap, Cambodia.
From cellos to chatting, or not as the case may be, poor or non-existent phone service in some parts of Mexico creates big problems for small business owners and farmers there. Telmex is the main phone company in Mexico and one of the world's most profitable. It's quickly rolling out new technology to keep up with ever-increasing demand, but most of it goes to urban residents. Rural areas are all but ignored. That makes it difficult for small entrepreneurs to compete in this increasingly connected world. Conrad Fox brings us this report from the state of Veracruz.
Manuel Sanchez stands sweating in the midst of 30 beehives and a cloud of bees. He heaves a heavy wooden tray full of honeycombs from the top of one of the hives, working quickly to avoid annoying its occupants. He's still a beginner at this.
This is the first really good harvest. Last year was just practice.
When he was laid off last year from his job, he, his wife, and a group of farmers in the small community of Palma Real formed a cooperative and invested in the hives. He's one of a growing number of entrepreneurs in this region, many of them tired of the low profits in farming.
If you plant 15 acres of corn, you're working 6 days a week, and at the end, you harvest 10 tons of corn, just 20,000 pesos. A ton of honey is worth 50,000. Now, the trick is to sell the honey.
But that is not going to be easy. These days, many businesses, even in Mexico, rely on a web page or an 800 number. In Palma Real, there isn't even a telephone. Emilio Facundo is a member of the Honeybee Cooperative. He says this is a big problem.
We've gone out to promote our honey, and people are like, where are you? How do I get in touch? Your honey might be really good, but if you live way out in some remote community with no communication, well, people are going to buy from a closer distributor.
Mexico suffers some of the worst disparities in telephone service in Latin America. In Mexico City and a few other urban areas, you can now get things like wireless internet and TV on your cell phone. But in some of the poorest regions, there are fewer than 5 telephone lines for every 100 households. Emilio Facundo explains why.
I once tried to get a line from Telmex, but they told me you have to have 200 families in the same community requesting one, and only 80 live here.
In fact, the phone company, Telmex, a monopoly in all but a handful of cities, is required by law to provide service in areas where 100 families request it. Critics say Telmex is not doing enough to provide service for the nation's rural poor. A Telmex spokesman refused to be interviewed for this story. This is the community store in the village of Pescador, a brisk half-hour walk from Palma Real. Pescador does have a phone system, sort of. Here's how it works.
Atención a este aviso. Se le comunica el señor Conrado Hawks que tiene llamada telefónica.
The single phone sits on the counter of the local community store. It's actually a cell phone with a large antenna mast planted out back. It was bought by the store owners, who charge you to make and receive calls. Say a call comes in for you. The caller hangs up, and the store announces your name on a loudspeaker. You leave your house or your field and go to the store and wait for the person to call back. That is, if the phone isn't already busy. For 5 years, Juana Hernandez ran her business selling handmade soaps and perfumes using this system. She says it was a nightmare.
If they call the store, the store isn't open all day. And sometimes they pass the message on, and sometimes they don't. And later the client asks us, where were you?
So last February, she spent $380 on a similar cell phone for herself. But she's not sure if it was worth the cost. With high rates even to receive a call, she estimates she spends about $80 a month on phone bills, about half her income. And, she says, the signal is so unreliable she still misses calls from clients. In a small workshop back in Palma Real, beekeeper Manuel Sanchez and his colleagues carefully strip honeycombs of their outer layer of wax, letting the thick golden liquid ooze out. With no telephone in Palma Real, how does he plan to compete with established companies?
Con señales de humo.
Smoke signals. Emilio and I are thinking about trying telepathy.
A new law passed by the Mexican Congress will soon bring more competition to Mexico's telephone market. But it's unclear if that will mean better service for the rural poor, or just high-tech extras, like more TV programs available for cell phones in the city. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Palma Real, Mexico.
Coming up, when marriage isn't a matter of choice. That's ahead on the World Vision Report, after this short break.
Ahora que el sol se va a dormir.
Ahora que el sol se va a dormir.
Se viste el cielo de carbón.
Se viste el cielo de carbón.
Y de una nube va a salir.
Y de una nube va a salir.
Trotando un caballito azul.
Trotando.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In developing countries, about a third of all brides are still children. That's been outlawed in Ethiopia, where the government says a man cannot marry a woman under the age of 18. But in the south of the country, the abduction of young girls is widespread. Richard Locke explains.
In a mud brick classroom, more than 60 young children sit perched on wooden benches, listening attentively to their teacher. Most of the children in this class are between 10 and 12 years old. For kids in the West, it's a time of innocence, but not so for some Ethiopian girls. It's around this age that girls here face being forced into early marriage. And as bizarre as it may sound to Westerners, many of those forced marriages begin with kidnapping, perhaps as many as 80% in some parts of the country. Pekita Eshete was just 13 years old when she was the victim of an attempted abduction. She remembers walking through a forest on her way home from school when she and her friends were attacked by a group of seven men.
It was very shocking because we didn't expect them to come from the forest. We were five, two girls and three boys. So they fought us. They beat us with sticks.
A year on, she recalls vividly how her abductor dragged her into the forest. She was only able to escape when the man grew nervous at the sound of police shouts. Several other girls at the Woolmera Primary School, about 25 miles outside of Addis Ababa, have been abducted in the last year. Here's why. By convention in Ethiopia, it's the man who's required to pay a dowry to his bride's family. But things are different if he kidnaps her. Once abducted, a girl is commonly viewed as spoiled or ruined because of the possibility she was raped. So in many cases, parents prefer to consent to the marriage than be shamed by their daughter's abduction. The likelihood is the man will only be required to pay a very small amount of money to marry the girl. Usually, village elders will be called in to mediate the situation. A few kilometres away, in the neighbouring village of Elela Gojo, 56-year-old Asafa Tamen listens to his radio as his baby grandson gurgles beside him. A respected elder in the local community, Tamen says he's mediated countless abductions and explains the process.
Elders come from both sides. What they do is, early in the morning, they took cows, many cows, and bring to the girl's parents' house. Then they discuss on the issues and then they mediate both parties.
Traditionally, the young girl has had little say in the matter. Nowadays, though, Tamen says, a girl has the right to say no to marriage.
In the previous years, girls have no rights. It is her parents, her mother and her father, who decided for her. But nowadays, the girls have right to go to court, to go to women's affair office and explain about themselves.
The reality, though, is far removed from what's written down on paper. Few cases ever go through the legal process. Local custom is still commonly preferred over the law courts as a means to settle disputes. Should a girl reject the elder's final decision, she risks being ostracized by her community. Back in the school's scorched garden, another pupil, 16-year-old Mazarete Jerson, says her father readily consented to her abductor's marriage proposal. Her marriage, she explains, was more important to her family than her education, which her father could not afford anyway.
The person who abducted me is a bit wealthier, so my father said to me, "What are you doing in education? Where will it get you? Now is the time to marry. This man will support you. You don't need to go to school." So then I married the person.
But after 8 months, Mazarat ran away from her husband. Once again, elders were called in to mediate.
The elders decided I should go back to my husband. They said, "You must, otherwise you will die. He will accuse you before the witch doctor, and you will die."
But she refused. Mazarat was lucky. Her brother took her in. Now he too no longer speaks to his father. The practice of kidnapping girls for marriage is declining in and around Ethiopia's major towns, as women's rights become more entrenched among the educated. But in remote, rural regions, it remains widespread. Aid groups here are encouraging families to go to the police rather than to village elders to sort out abduction cases. They hope the courts will uphold the rights of girls, rights that are too often surrendered to traditional custom. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Woomera, Ethiopia.
It might sound unlikely, but another country that's dealing with the issue of forced marriage is England. That's because of the country's large immigrant population. The British government has launched a special unit to tackle the issue, and we invited its director onto the show to talk about his work. I started by asking him how he defined forced marriage as opposed to an arranged marriage.
The definition that we go by is where the consent is missing. There's also a second element to that. There may also be duress. That's either emotional duress or physical duress. Oftentimes it's both.
How often does this really happen in England, and who's doing this?
Well, it's very hard to say really how often it happens. Forced marriage is an aspect of a wider phenomenon that we call honour crimes or so-called honour crimes. And because elements of honour and shame are involved, it's a very underreported phenomenon. The forced marriage unit, though, handles approximately 300 cases of forced marriage every year and receives about 5,000 inquiries. But we're just one unit dealing with this. There are other non-governmental organisations, refuges, women's organisations, who handle cases of forced marriage every day like we do. So I would say the 300 cases a year that we deal with is just the very tip of the iceberg.
And these are 300 in Great Britain, or British citizens?
Yeah, we only handle cases of British citizens who are forced into marriage, but those can be overseas or in the UK.
Which groups of people in England are more likely to be engaged in these kind of honour crimes?
About 65% of our cases originate in families of Pakistani origin. 25% of our cases originate in families of Bangladeshi origin. So it's fairly clear from those statistics that the majority of forced marriage cases are happening in specific communities. Now, I should say we've seen cases from across the world. You know, we've seen cases in Ireland, for example, in Spain, in Turkey, all across the world, even in North America.
Can you explain the phenomenon of forced marriage? What is the thinking behind this? You called it an honor crime. Why is it an honor crime? And what is forced marriage all about?
I'm speaking slightly hypothetically here when I say that there are many different reasons why forced marriages happen. The overwhelming reason, though, is to correct behavior that parents see their children entering into, behavior that they might associate with becoming too westernized. So, for example, a mother and a father might force their 18-year-old daughter to marry somebody from Pakistan because she has started drinking alcohol, or she is dating a white guy. Or for another very, very difficult example is if she is gay, for example. So really, forced marriage is seen, I think, as a kind of an antidote, if you will, to overtly westernized young people.
And how do you force an 18-year-old to marry someone? I mean, I've got these images of dragging someone down an aisle. I mean, can't these young people refuse to marry who their parents have chosen for them?
Yes, of course. Of course they can refuse. But what I think it's very hard for us to understand is quite the level of emotional blackmail and emotional duress that is being put upon these young people. They often come from communities which are so much more close-knit than perhaps other communities that we might be familiar with, that the emotional pressure is not just coming from the parents, but it's coming from everybody they see as they walk down the street. And also, you've got to remember that a lot of these cases happen overseas. So if a young 17-year-old Pakistani boy is taken off to Pakistan, he will find himself in a village as unfamiliar as it would be to either you or I. He might not know how to get out of the village and how to get to the capital city to find assistance. So they're really, really very isolated, both in emotional terms and in physical terms very often.
So all of these kids are British citizens, but if they drag a boy to Pakistan, to a village where he doesn't even speak the language, and force him to marry who the family has chosen, how do you, as a British unit, get involved? That must be pretty difficult.
It is difficult, and sometimes it's the most challenging part of our job. And occasionally we do feel slightly like a sort of cross between a private detective and a special agent. But you know, oftentimes I've said they're very isolated, and they are isolated, but young people will have friends, and they will have spoken to people, and they might have spoken to a teacher or a friend of theirs at school, or if they're particularly concerned about the situation they're going into before they leave the UK, they might contact the police, or they might contact our unit before they leave.
And then you send somebody over to rescue them or stop the wedding?
No, we have what we have is sort of teams of experts, basically based in the high commissions or our embassies in these countries, who are expert in providing assistance to British nationals in trouble. But in those countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, they have a particular expertise in rescuing victims of forced marriage. So if it becomes necessary, they will travel to that village, speak to the victim herself or himself, and find out whether they actually want to be rescued and repatriated back to the UK.
And if they say yes, they want to be rescued, how do you actually carry out such a rescue?
Well, if they want to come back with us, we always travel out with a local police escort for protection. And if they want to return with us, then they can. We will escort them back to in the case of Pakistan, escort them back to Islamabad, where we work very closely with a women's refuge to provide safe accommodation. The refuge is fantastic, actually, I should say. I was there a couple of months ago, and they provide medical support. There's also a resident psychiatrist who can provide mental counselling, and they will stay there for approximately two or three nights until we can arrange for them to fly back to the UK.
On your website, there's a story of a girl whose family beat her when she didn't do what they wanted her to do regarding marriage. How does your unit respond to cases like that?
Well, unfortunately, we have to respond every day to cases involving physical abuse, rape, threats of intense violence. We are provided with the same kind of consular training to deal with violent situations that is given to all our consular staff in the UK and in our embassies overseas. But we work very closely with colleagues in the police, in social services, and in women's groups nationwide. So we've got a vast network of support that we can fall back on, that can also provide assistance to girls and men who are going through very, very serious situations indeed.
Do you have a success story, a recent one that you'd like to share with us?
We have success stories all the time. I helped a young girl, for example, and she called me up recently to say that she had just got her driving license. She had changed her name after surviving a forced marriage. She had changed her name. She'd passed her driving test, and her driving license had her new name on it. And she called me up, and she was absolutely thrilled, because the ability to drive a car, as you know, is a real sign of freedom, and the ability to have her driving license with her new name on it was a real symbol for her of the new life that she had just embarked upon. So it's absolutely wonderful to hear those stories.
Peter Abbott, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Peter Abbott is the director of the UK's Forced Marriage Unit. He spoke to us from London. Herbal medicine is an age-old tradition in the United States that's still practiced by some people. Not too long ago, it was the only form of health care for Americans who couldn't afford a doctor. In Detroit, reporter Kyle Norris met a woman who grew up relying on plants and herbs. Here's Kyle's reporter's notebook.
A young guy on crutches hobbles up the steps into an old storefront. The store is called Nature's Products, and it's in a rough commercial neighborhood.
Somebody referred me to this place. They told me I should go here. This is where I should go for some natural nature, whatever he said, products. I said, okay. So it sounded good to me as far as anything that can help me with, you know, my problem. Oh, this golden seed, I don't know.
The man's foot is all puffed up from a spider bite.
Echinacea? Mm-hmm. Echinacea.
He's already seen a doctor, but says that treatment isn't working. So he's coming here as a last resort. Owner Gary Wanaja tells the man to use echinacea and golden seal. He explains how to make a foot bath, which he says will draw out the venom. These days, stores that sell natural remedies are pretty hot, despite the fact that many remedies remain untested by Western science. But people have always used herbs and plants as medicine. Many of the customers who come to this store are actually older folks who grew up using them. One customer is 73-year-old Faith, and that's her legal name, by the way, just Faith.
When you come in my kitchen, it's quite a lot of stuff. You're going to see vitamins. You're going to see tons of teas, just lots of teas. Teas over here, teas over here, teas on the floor. There are a lot of teas in this house.
In Faith's cozy kitchen, there are big plastic jugs everywhere, all along the shelves and on the floor. The jugs are filled with things like mint and wild catnip, which, believe it or not, still grows wild around Detroit. There's also a cough syrup Faith made from lemons, limes, and oranges. Faith makes me a cup of mint chamomile, which she says is great for digestion. And she's drinking a tea called Throat Coat to help stave off a cold. We both scoop out big spoonfuls of raw honey and stir them into our cups. Faith was born and raised in a segregated farming community in Louisiana called Quiche during Jim Crow days. Her father grew watermelons and peanuts. Like most people in Quiche, they didn't have much money. And so they found other ways to live without it.
Money? Esther. Oh, we're supposed to have that. Okay. We bartered.
Well, I lived in a bartering society. You bring me a mess of greens, and I'll bring you some potatoes. You bring me some peanuts, and I'll take you something else. It was a bartering society.
People had this hands-on approach to almost everything, including their health. Faith says when she was growing up, there were no doctors to go to. She lived in a rural area, so there weren't many nearby, and no one had the cash to pay for one anyway. Plus, many white doctors would refuse to treat black patients. So people used herbs for their specific problems, and also to just stay well.
Every spring, in the spring of the year, we were given sassafras tea, and that was a bitterweed tea, to clean our bodies. In the fall of the year, we were given teas again to clean our body to prepare us for the winter. Then we had very healthy food, no chemicals, none of the stuff we have today.
Back then, everybody shared what they knew about remedies. If you had a certain problem and you didn't know what to do, you just asked your neighbor. Faith is still very generous with her knowledge. I asked her to recommend a tea to help me with my allergies. And she hands me this bag filled with what looks like wood shavings and little sticks.
You should taste that. Why don't you take a little piece in that top one and just chew it?
I chew on a piece of root, and this strong licorice flavor bursts in my mouth.
Ooh, it's really, like, wakes me up, you know?
Yes.
Turns out Faith had gone over to the Nature's Products store and talked with owner Gary Wanaja. Together, they came up with my own special blend. I'll admit at first I was a little skeptical to drink this tea made from all these little twiggy things. But it's actually really been helping. There's a fear that as we become more modern, we'll lose this long line of old-time country knowledge. There's also a fear that we're losing a communal way of caring for each other. But the knowledge is surviving in little pockets. Faith has been showing her 21-year-old grandson how to use herbs. And she's taught me a few really cool things, like how to make a hot pepper tea. You can drink it, or you can breathe in its steam at the first sign of a cold or flu. Faith tells me it'll nip that thing in the bud.
Kyle Norris is a reporter based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Coming up on the World Vision Report, a look at where trash and your tourist dollars end up in the Caribbean. That's after this short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. A recycling project in one of Haiti's slums has found a new use for trash, and it could end up addressing some of the country's most pressing environmental problems. From Port-au-Prince, reporter Amelia Shaw has more.
These days, the streets of Carrefour Feria have never been so clean. Every day, residents here shovel more than 18 tons of garbage into trucks, which they then deliver to a new waste management factory up the road. Rose Antoine Duverceau, a single mother of two, is one of hundreds of street cleaners hired for the project.
You should have seen this neighborhood before the project. It was full of garbage, dirty, ugly. We are very satisfied with the way things are now.
For local leader Patrick Massena, the cleanup project is a boon to a community that has struggled for decades against poverty and gang warfare.
This project responds to three needs. One, it reduces violence here. Two, it increases people's buying power by creating employment. Three, it is creating a cleaner, more sanitary environment.
In the factory, workers separate the garbage into piles of plastics, glass, and metals, which are sold to recycling companies in Canada. But it is the paper waste that's the most important item here. They use it to make charcoal. Workers pound wet paper into a pulp using a large mortar and pestle. They mix the pulp with sawdust, then put it in cylinders and squeeze out all the water. When it's done, out pops a 4-inch wide round paper cake. Once it dries in the sun, it's ready to burn. Project officials hope that these paper briquettes will provide a cheap renewable energy source for the poor and save Haiti's trees along the way. Sejour Ginette is a paper briquette maker. She has 7 children who now go to school thanks to the money she makes working at the factory. She says for Haitian moms, cooking with paper briquettes may win out over traditional charcoal made from wood.
There is a big difference. With recycled paper briquettes, it only costs about 8 cents to cook a pot of beans, but it takes at least 25 cents using regular charcoal, so it's a lot cheaper.
Not only that, paper briquettes may save Haiti's few remaining trees. The making of wood-based charcoal has deforested an astonishing 98% of Haiti's tree cover. The deforestation is so severe that the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic can be clearly seen from space. The result has been widespread erosion and increasing susceptibility to floods. But if enough people switch to recycled paper charcoal, then there is hope that the country can mitigate these severe environmental problems. The Paper Briquette Project is funded by a consortium of 3 countries, Brazil, India, and South Africa, and the United Nations Development Program. Eliana Nicolini is with the UNDP, and she helps supervise the project. She calls it an experiment in social reconstruction.
Le PNUD a travaillé à plusieurs reprises avec la communauté.
The UNDP met many times, she says, with the community members to construct the project with them. Their objective was to get community support with the strategy of collecting, separating, and composting garbage. Community support is particularly important in the violent and unpredictable neighborhood of Carrefour Ferry. Local leader Patrick Massena says the community has been won over, and recently there was proof of that.
During the food riots in Port-au-Prince in April, nobody threw rocks at the factory. It wasn't ransacked. People protected it because they identify with it. They see themselves as part of the project.
The factory produces 450 briquettes a day. They're being tested by the Ministry of Public Health to make sure they comply with safety standards. Once they've passed inspection, the project plans to recruit local street vendors to sell the briquettes for about 2 cents apiece. It's a creative way to turn one person's garbage into another's charcoal. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia Shaw in Port-au-Prince.
A small village in Honduras hopes ecotourism will help its struggling economy. Writer Kelsey Timmerman visited there with his brother to check it out. But instead of exploring the jungle, they ended up playing soccer in it.
When you're playing soccer on a sandbar, the dugout canoe is not out of bounds. Oh, and the ball is playable in the river. Soccer is a universal language, but when I played the game in Mocorone, there were some rules that took some getting used to. With a flick of his foot, a boy of about 11 sends a soccer ball ricocheting off the bow of a boat. It heads to his 9-year-old teammate standing in front of my goal. The kid fakes right. I fall for it. He shoots left. The ball rolls between the goal markers, 2 piles of curly wood shavings from a recently carved canoe. Goal. The kid struts by me to give his teammate a high five. He barely comes past my waist. Word of our game has spread among the kids at the village, and our numbers swell. At one point, my brother Kyle is surrounded by 5 of them. 10 little brown bare feet whack at the ball. I can't decide what he's trying harder to do, kick the ball or not squash anyone. Kyle and I grew up playing soccer in a small league in Ohio. We wore shin guards, had matching uniforms, and were treated to little plastic barrels of sugary fruit drinks whether we won or lost. The kids in Mocorone, on the other hand, wear shirts given to them by relief organizations. One shirt says, Benton High School, class of 95. Another has a dancing Snoopy on it. None of them know who Snoopy is. As for refreshments, the kids drink the river water by the handful. There aren't even any soccer balls here. Kids play with anything that is semi-round and kickable. In this land of hunger and malaria, the shiny new soccer balls that we brought are a luxurious treat. The game continues, but the sun and the humidity are ruthless. Then, in mid-play, without a signal or a word, every kid, player and spectator alike, runs into the river. Kyle and I are left on the makeshift field, scratching our heads, wondering, who called the timeout? The second time this happens, we follow. Eventually, we learn the rule. If at any point in time a player is hot and feels a need to plunge into the river, he or she may do so, regardless of the score. All are required to follow. The third break, Kyle leads the way. Tonight it will start raining and won't stop for 12 hours. By tomorrow morning, the sandbar that is our field will be lost beneath the swollen river. The wood shavings that marked our goals will be drifting to the Caribbean Sea. Our simple soccer field will be washed away. Our soccer balls won't last long either. The sandbar does not lack for sharp rocks and is hard on bare feet. It's also hard on $25 soccer balls. Ours goes flat. We brought the balls all the way from Ohio with the hope that the kids of Mocaron will be playing with them for months to come. Every guest hopes their gift outlasts their stay. The backup ball goes flat. Everybody, into the river.
Kelsey Timmerman is a writer and columnist. He says he lives far from the jungle, in the middle of a cornfield near Greenville, Ohio. The Caribbean is a favorite tourist destination, and if you visit the resorts and hotels there, you might assume that the money you spend helps the people who live and work in the area. But Tricia Barnett says very few tourist dollars end up in the hands of the people who serve you. Barnett is head of an organization called Tourism Concern. We spoke with her from her offices in London.
I was recently in the Dominican Republic, which is in the Caribbean, as you know, and I went back with my chambermaid to her house and had a long talk with her, as I did with other waiters and other gardeners and people. The hotel was owned by somebody who lived in Florida. And my waitress, Conchita, she didn't even earn enough to buy milk for the family, and she worked all hours. So very often the money gets sent outside of the country, the profits go outside of the country. Also, when you went to this hotel, when you had breakfast, for example, there were, I counted nearly 200 combinations of different choices for breakfast, and almost everything that I could see had been imported in. So you'd get Dutch cheeses and German sausages and smoked salmon and asparagus. This is in the Dominican Republic. So a lot of the money that we pay for the holiday also goes to import a lot of the food and a lot of the alcohol and a lot of the things that we want to make us most comfortable. And it's not really being spent on encouraging local farmers to produce food for the holidaymakers.
But I imagine that the tourism companies and the owners of these hotels would argue that they're getting paid as well or maybe even better than the other people on the island, that these are competitive wages and that they're doing a great good for the community by offering so many jobs. They employ thousands of people.
That is absolutely true, Peggy. If you're a cane cutter and you're Haitian and you've come through the Dominican Republic, you'll be earning maybe a third, a dollar a day, of what a hotel worker will be earning. But neither of these things are acceptable. You can't say because somebody earns, you know, more than the cane cutter, what they're doing is acceptable. That person is working so that we can have a great time. Surely they've got to have a great time too. They've got to be really pleased to see us, and those smiles have got to be genuine. And what Conchita said to me was that behind a smile was a huge amount of misery. We want everyone to enjoy themselves, and that means that our holidays will be better for us.
Tricia, your organization has put out a book called The Ethical Traveler, which tells me how I can take a good vacation and make sure I'm not part of exploiting the poor in the region I'm visiting. So let's say I have a week vacation. I'm here in Texas, so I can take a two-hour flight to Cancun. It's very easy for me to call my local travel agent and get a nice hotel and get a package deal. How would I do that vacation differently so that my money goes into the local community and not just into an American conglomerate that owns an enormous tourist business?
There's a couple of ways you could do it. You could either turn to the Ethical Travel Guide and choose a place direct and organise it with them direct and book your flights. Or you can do it through tour operators who are connected to groups like that who are providing some fantastic holiday facilities. Or you can book your two-hour flight to Cancun with a package and take time out of it and explore other places that might be nearby from the guide.
Can you tell me about one of the vacations that you all describe in your book that are ethical and pour money back into the community?
I had the extraordinary privilege of going to visit some community-owned tourism hotels or lodges in the Ecuadorian, deep into the Amazonian jungle. They've started community-based tourism initiatives down there for a wonderful reason, and that's to defend the rainforest. You can hike through the rainforest for a couple of hours with a guide and arrive at an initiative where you'll actually find you've got a room of your own, you've got mosquito netting, and local people come and cook the food and take you on jungle treks. So by defending the rainforest through this sort of tourism, which some people call ecotourism, it's a rather magical thing, because what they have to offer is the most fantastic treks through the jungle, no more than you can actually manage, wonderful cultural experiences as you learn to understand how local people live and eat and get their food and communicate with each other. So there are these extremely important experiences that you can have that not only provide you with a holiday, but provide local people with ways and means to salvage their lifestyles.
Tricia Barnett, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Tricia Barnett is director of the group Tourism Concern. For more information about the organization or about their book, The Ethical Travel Guide, go to worldvisionreport.org. At the beginning of the show, we brought you the story of a Liberian journalist who uses a chalkboard on the street to get out the news. There are many other people working on Monrovia's main streets. They're street vendors, and they usually sell food or cheap clothing. But in the busy capital of Liberia, reporter Nico Colombant came across a typing teacher who sells his wares the same way others sell sandwiches or sandals. Here's the latest installment in our street vendor series.
Sylvester Yangbe types out a price list on a beaten-up, faded blue manual typewriter. He reads out some of the classes he offers in a building with no front wall. Learn fast and good typing, he reads, and how to fill in legal documents.
Where you have to do legal documents.
The cost of a three-month program here is about $10. Yangbe makes several hundred dollars a month with this work. It's just enough to feed his family and send several children, some his own and some not, to school. Yangbe sets out several typewriters on school desks outside the building, which has become a squatter home for a few poor families.
I have so many machines, as you can see. This is what we call Olympia. We have Olivetti's and so on.
Yangbe kept these from the 1980s, when he worked as an accountant and gave typing classes in the remote town where he was born. That was before he became a displaced person, like so many others who fled to Monrovia to escape the fighting during the recent civil war. He says he's a bit ashamed of his condition and his country now.
We try, but you know, our own country, we lack our system. If you look in the street of Monrovia, the living condition now in Liberia is harder as compared to any other administration since this country was founded.
There are about 20 students in Yangbe's program. One of them is Isaiah Thomas. He's here early today for his class and is finishing up his homework assignment on a clunky paint-chipped typewriter. He sits in a small rickety chair as street children play around him. He's painstakingly typed a sentence that reads, "Without the people, we cannot do anything for our people." Thomas is a 33-year-old high school dropout, father of three. He used to work as a nighttime security guard until he got pneumonia.
For now in Liberia, we are suffering. There is no job. So for that, we want to learn, but how can we learn? So for this reason, some of us, we decide to come here and learn how to type so that we can get our daily bread through that.
Thomas hopes he can one day get a job as a secretary. Sometimes, if a typewriter is open after class, Yangbe will let Thomas use it to make some money of his own. He'll type out forms, applications, and ID cards for passersby who need them filled. With few computers and very little electricity, manual typewriters are still essential here. Yangbei says several of his street-side graduates have gone on to work on computers for some of the international aid groups here.
If you wish to do a computer, you must have a typing skill. So once you do a manual machine, then it's easier to get along on computer.
Yangbei says he feels he's playing a part in rebuilding his country, one old typewriter stroke at a time. For the World Vision Report, I'm Nico Columbant in Monrovia, Liberia.
There are photos of the typing street vendor on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that brings us to the end of our show. If you want to know more about our program or any of the stories we featured on the show, check out our website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. We have a link there so you can podcast the show and listen to it whenever you want. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.